This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Voters don't choose their politicians so much these days as politicians choose their voters. The combination of a partisan process in most states and increasingly sophisticated computer software allows politicians to redraw the lines of electoral districts to maximize their party's chances. They lump as many of their opponents' voters as they can into two or three districts and then spread out their own supporters to give their candidates a nice, safe cushion come Election Day. Next Tuesday, Ohio and California will vote to reform redistricting laws. The proposals are somewhat different, but both would take the power to draw the lines away from politicians and put it in the hands of independent bipartisan commissions. The goal is to create competitive races and drop district maps that look more like squares and less like snakes. The problem is that neither of those goals is hard, and both may be impossible. Later in the program, we'll go to Pakistan, where there's a race with winter to provide shelter for millions left homeless by last month's earthquake. But first, the paradoxes and pitfalls of redistricting reform. If you're in Ohio or California, give us a call and tell us how the issue is playing out there. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with Joe Hallett. He's a senior editor at the Columbus Dispatch and has been writing about Ohio's redistricting ballot initiative. And he joins us from his office. Answer that phone first, and welcome to the program.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Neil.
That's all right. In 2004, as everybody remembers, the presidential race in Ohio was pretty close. In congressional races, Ohio selected 12 Republicans and 6 Democrats. There are similar patterns for the legislature and the state Senate. How is that possible in a state that's roughly 50-50?
Well, it is roughly 50-50. There are Bush beat Kerry here by only 2 points. There are almost equal numbers of votes in the aggregate for the 18 congressional candidates. And the reason it's so lopsided is because the lines are gerrymandered to be lopsided. There are 18 congressional districts in the state, and maybe 4 of them are competitive. There are 33 state senate districts, and probably 5 are competitive. And of the 99 Ohio House districts, it's generous to say that maybe 15 of them could be won by either party.
And who draws the district lines now?
Well, it's a panel called the State Apportionment Board, and it is comprised of 2 members from opposite parties of the General Assembly, the governor, the Secretary of State, and the state auditor. And so the party that wins 2 of the 3 races for auditor, secretary of state, and governor then controls the controlling board, which draws legislative districts, and then the General Assembly draws congressional districts.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ohio, the General Assembly and all of state government, in fact, has been controlled by Republicans overwhelmingly for the last 10 years.
And is it safe to say that the redistricting reform effort is supported largely by Democrats?
Yes, absolutely. That's kind of the impetus. I think there are 5 ballot issues on the Ohio ballot in November 8th, and they all kind of come out of the national partisan anger, I think, from 2004. But redistricting is the one that has drawn the most attention here. And oddly enough, both sides in favor are the Democrats. And there are some good government groups, such as Common Cause and others, that have joined on. And oddly enough, the opponents of Issue 4, the redistricting amendment, mostly Republicans in their allied business groups, admit that the way we draw districts now is unfair and needs to be reformed. They just say that the current ballot remedy is the wrong remedy.
Mm-hmm. It should be pointed out that in California, where you have sort of a maverick Republican as governor and Democrats control the state legislature and have for a long time, it's the Republicans who are agitating for redistricting reform in that state and the Democrats who are resisting it. But anyway, getting back to Ohio, if you look at these arguments, the arguments that are made by the Republicans saying this is the wrong proposal, well, they say, look, the Ohio proposal, the way it's written up, would emphasize the most important thing drawing up a new district would be that it be competitive, roughly equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats in each district. They say you do that, you end up with lines that wander all over the state. They're not compact, contiguous districts.
Yes, that's right, and they've even put out sample maps. Anyone in Ohio could draw a map, and it would be submitted to a new commission, an independent five-member commission that is chosen by judges. And they would ascertain which map, which congressional district map, scores highest on a competitiveness scale. And obviously the most number of districts that could be won by either party would get the highest score. But what's happened here is that the debate has, and I think very cleverly so by the opponents of issue 4 of redistricting, has turned on what these maps might look like. And as a result, the opponents have put out a sample redistricting map, which they say scores 26, which is the highest anyone has submitted so far, which has districts that look like string beans. I mean, there is one congressional district that snakes along the western border of Ohio with Indiana that goes all the way from Toledo to Cincinnati. Now, the opponents have put up their own maps, and they show more compactness, but both of them are not exactly showing compact districts, and the Ohio proposal differs from California and any other redistricting proposal we've seen in that it the top criteria, the high priority for the line drawers is competitiveness. California focuses on compact districts and, you know, trying to avoid the sprawling, oddly shaped districts that have been drawn in that state.
And a week away from the election, what do the polls suggest how issue number 4, the redistricting proposal, is going to do there?
Well, we did a poll October 1st, and it was shown to be losing by 12 points, but there were 36% of the respondents who were undecided. I think that the polling still shows that it's going to go down. It's going down. Part of the reason is because it's very complicated. It's confusing. You talk about sprawl. It sprawls all over the ballot. I think a lot of voters are not going to understand it. And when that happens, they usually turn thumbs down.
Joe Hallett, thanks very much.
Happy to help.
Joe Hallett, senior editor at the Columbus Dispatch. He joined us from his office there. Let's turn now to Rob Ritchie. He's executive director of the Center for Voting and Democracy, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that looks at elections. They're based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And Rob Ritchie has been kind enough to come in and join us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
Very glad to be here.
Now, as you look at that ballot initiative in Ohio and also at Proposition 77, the redistricting proposal in California, part of the problems that they present is that the solutions are sometimes almost as strange looking as the problem.
That's right. And part of that is because it's one of these sort of zero-sum dynamics often where if you're trying to accomplish one goal, it can cut against another goal. And that's one of the complex parts of this that I think we're all pretty much agree that that we're in a very difficult situation, a very problematic one where, you know, we've had single-digit incumbent defeats since 1996.
Little turnover in elections.
Very little turnover. More than 40% of state legislative races aren't even contested by two parties these days. So lack of competition is rampant. Partisan corruption is very clear and transparent. You know, Tom DeLay is in trouble because of this. And yet when you get to solutions, at least the kind of solutions that are on the table right now tend to have some arguments against them that can undercut the
public
fact that we
support,
need to do something.
800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Paul's on the line with a question from Philadelphia.
Hi, yeah. My question was, why isn't districting simply done by county, city, or township lines?
That's the contiguous compact district argument. Why isn't it done that way?
Well, that's how Iowa tries to do it. Iowa has a nonpartisan criteria-driven process, and that's one of their key criteria. Let's not try to break up the jurisdiction line so that voters who have a sort of a political coherence to it, so if you and I live in the same county, we'll likely have the same representative. But that doesn't accomplish some of the other goals, like in Ohio. If you're really going to try to use single-member districts in a way to try to give more voters choices in competitive elections, you often have to split up counties because counties tend to have a partisan tilt. People tend to go places and live with other people who are more like them than different from them.
The expression I've heard is that we Americans tend to live in landslide counties.
Landslide counties. That's, you know, so if you look at the presidential race, the red-blue maps by county, you see great geographic coherence, you know, that whole swaths of area are blue and others are red. So if you draw squares combining those counties, you know, you're typically going to get a red district or a blue district.
So, Paul, if you were doing that in Philadelphia, for example, you'd get a whole lot of blue districts. Democrats would just be elected there.
Well, doesn't that seem more fair? I don't know. To me, it seems like a fairly straight, cut-and-dry issue, like, if you live in an area with a majority of Democrats, then maybe it should be a Democratic district.
But if you have 90% Democrats in one district and 60% Republicans in a lot of other districts, you're going to end up electing a lot of Republicans and not too many Democrats.
Right, but I still think that seems to be the fairest proportional representation.
That's another proposal. But it's
fair within a certain definition of fairness, and it is the classic definition of what a fair redistricting process should be. Let's keep compact districts, make them look as squarish as possible. But then when you see that representation matters a great deal to people, and fairness can be defined in a number of different ways, one of the ways that is seen as fair is that if a political party and the candidates supporting it win, you know, 55% of the statewide vote, they should win a majority of seats. That won't necessarily happen when you draw nice square districts, and you also might not achieve some other goals, which is trying to provide fair representation of racial minorities, opportunities for other communities of interest to win seats.
And people also argue that if it's a safe Democratic or a safe Republican seat, the real contest is in the party primary. It tends to drive both parties to the extremes, more liberal Democrats, more conservative Republicans, at the loss of the center. So what to do? Well, that's exactly what we're talking today. Paul, thanks very much for the phone call. 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join our conversation about redistricting and who should draw election maps, I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about voting districts. California and Ohio voters will decide next Tuesday who should draw the lines, citizens or politicians. You're invited to join in. Are you happy with the political map where you live? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, Iowa Congressman James Leach will talk to us about his own experience with redistricting. Right now, we're still talking with Rob Ritchie. He's executive director of the Center for Voting and Democracy based in Maryland. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Josh, and Josh is calling from Santa Cruz in California.
Hi,
you're on the air.
I was just calling actually to ask why aren't districts drawn by shared economic interests and social services? I understand that can start spreading out across, you know, the state, but I was wondering if that was a more viable alternative.
Yeah, what is a community of interest? Is it a physical community where you live, or are these things more amorphous, Rob?
Right. Well, classically, I think people saw our geographic differences being symptomatic of a lot of the other differences that we think should be fairly represented, so that, you know, you would have farmers in a particular area, and if they get one representative, you know, that person would be sort of representing farmers. We certainly do see a lot more mixing of people. The districts have gotten a lot bigger. We now have the average house size at about 650,000 people. Mm-hmm. So you've got a lot of differences just based on that. If it's a push-pull situation, as long as one person is going to try to represent everyone in a particular area, it really means that where you live is more important than what you think and what your interests are, unless some group of sort of elite deciders of our representation as they draw districts try to accommodate your aspirations as a voter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's having other people make decisions that in some ways we would like to see the voters decide.
But have people drawn up maps using ideas of economic or social interests as a model?
It's a factor. It's a fascinating process of how district lines are drawn. What I hope we can see coming out of this is that if these measures do go down, as it looks quite plausible, that the conversation doesn't stop and that we look at what commissions are already doing. And there's a number of models out there, certainly a lot of international models, different voting methods as well. And to try to see what criteria should govern redistricting, and it probably won't be the same everywhere, but we should have that conversation everywhere and see more models that we can see how they work.
It's been fascinating to read that you get a different map of California depending on whether you start drawing districts from south to north or from north to south.
that would make sense. And our east to west or west to east. California, by the way, is one of those states where every coastal district is represented by a Democrat, except some of the ones right down near San Diego. And every interior district representing the states to the east of California is represented by a Republican. That red-blue divide, you know, has these strong impact on how we vote. So if you start one direction versus the other, yes, you're going to have some impacts.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling, Josh. Let's talk to Steve, and Steve's calling from Mountain View, California.
Californians for electoral reform.
Uh-huh.
And the point that I wanted to make is that you cannot have a district that is both competitive and representative. If a district is competitive, meaning it can go either way, the margin of victory is going to be 5% or less, meaning at least 47% of the people wanted somebody else to represent them. If a district is representative, meaning the winner gets an overwhelming majority of the vote, at least 60%, then it's not going to be competitive. And so you have this zero-sum game with single-member districts. You cannot solve the problem of having a district that's both competitive and representative. So what our organization advocates is proportional representation.
I knew we were going there.
Using multi-member districts where you allocate the winners based upon direct proportion to how people vote.
Well, redistricting reform is on the ballot, though. It's not being favored by voters in either Ohio or California at the moment. What about proportional representation?
Well, it is the international norm. So most modern democracies use proportional voting systems. And I think as one goes deeper into this debate, I think Steve fingered a very clear paradox, which is if you have a competitive district, even if it is representative in that one election of a certain point of view, it very easily won't be representative of that the next time. And certain kinds of representation we probably want to have pretty consistently represented, or else people feel, you know, less connected to their legislatures. I think proportional systems are often thought to be sort of one thing, and people think it's like, oh, that's what, didn't they use that in Italy? And mm-hmm. It has, like, you know, 400 parties elected, and, you know, and the reality is there's a whole family of systems, some of which open the door a lot less to multi-party democracy than others. The one that we think particularly speaks to this debate, and as we look at the kind of measure that would plausibly be on the ballot and I think be a strong one in the short term, would be what Illinois used to use. They had three-seat constituencies, so they had three representatives in a district rather than one, and they used a voting method. Their particular method was cumulative voting, but it's one of these proportional systems where it took about a third of the vote to win one of the three seats and a majority to win two out of three. And what you typically saw was one party winning two seats, the other party winning one, third parties being around and able to hold the major parties accountable. But you did balance more of the goals that people are seeking, which is voter choice and sort of continuity of representation, more representation of some of the interests that the callers have been mentioning.
Steve, thanks very much, and good luck.
You're quite welcome.
Bye-bye. Joining us now from his office in Washington is Congressman James Leach of Iowa, 2nd District, though he used to represent the 1st District of Iowa. Congressman, nice to have you on the program.
Well, good to be with you, Neil.
In 2000, Iowa redistricted, forcing you to move districts. You had a much tighter race on your hands than you'd had before. Essentially, you had more work. Tell us what happened.
Well, Iowa has probably the model redistricting plan in the country. Most redistricting is done to protect incumbents of both parties. It's sometimes done in a state to disadvantage a party, but more likely than not, it's a incumbent protection circumstance. Iowa has a nonpartisan commission that redistricts as honestly as any state in the country, and it generally, therefore, creates some discombobulation, but most of all, it for the sake of the public, it creates very competitive races.
Mm-hmm. And discombobulation, you had to move.
I did. About two-thirds of the people I represented were in an area where my home was not. So I moved with the majority of people I represented, but I did have to leave my hometown. And that's a very awkward thing to do in life.
Is in those circumstances, obviously an awkward thing to do and difficult to do, worth it?
Well, in an electoral sense, it worked. In a personal sense, it's difficult to leave a hometown.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate that I moved to the home of the University of Iowa in Iowa City, which is, in my judgment, one of the cultural capitals of the country. And so, in a lifestyle sense, to live in a university environment is something that's a great plus.
As you pointed out correctly, Iowa has some of the most competitive, certainly congressional races anywhere in the country, certainly in terms of proportion. Yet, I think if you go back, Iowa incumbents do very well.
Generally, all incumbents do rather well in America today, although in Iowa the races are usually much more competitive than elsewhere. But as you know, Neil, redistricting is one of these subjects that's about as interesting as someone else's genealogy.
We're hoping it's more interesting than that today, at least.
Yes, sir. On the other hand, very few things are more important to the health of our democracy. And, you know, we have the great question whether politicians choose their voters or voters their politicians.
Mm-hmm.
This is a dramatic query.
And I know you're a member of the Republican Party.
Yes, sir.
But competition seems to be good for in any endeavor of humankind.
Well, it surely is. And we do have an awkward thing as well, though, that in the House, there are 435 House seats, of which about 380 are considered safe seats. About half of those are Democratic, half Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And so it means that in those seats, one is inclined, if one's a Republican, to in all likelihood be in the right side of the party, and if one's a Democrat, to be in the left side of the party. And unlike in a presidential race where people, after primaries, kind of scoot to the center, in Congress, your only incentive is to stay right and stay left, because the only challenge will be within the party. And so institutionally, when you have a Congress composed overwhelmingly, 85% at least, of safe seats, that means composed of people of the fairly far to the right, fairly far to the left, who have no incentive to compromise. And so you have a kind of an institutional shootout. You know, there in philosophy, there's this principle of thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
In Congress, you usually get the thesis or the antithesis. You're very seldom these days getting the synthesis.
Congressman Leach, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Neil.
Jim Leach, Republican who represents Iowa's 2nd District. He called us from his office here on Capitol Hill. And that polarization argument that Congressman Leach was talking about, Rob Ritchie, that is compelling to a lot of people.
It sure is. I think that bothers people more about our politics than almost anything else right now.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Jerry. Jerry's calling us from Flint, Michigan.
Yes. The question I have is, why redistrict? I mean, people don't move into a district because of, you know, if it's Democratic or Republican, they move into a district because of a job. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me to redistrict. All their politicians' tool.
Well, it's interesting. We have a whole a history of action and non-action on whether to redistrict. In the 1960s, there was some big Supreme Court rulings requiring equal population of districts, and they needed to do those because some states weren't redistricting. And so they were having some districts literally be 10 times the population of other districts. And we can do that with the U.S. Senate right now, but we can't do it with anything else. And the problem is that you can have, majorities sort of spread around in the wrong districts that the population differences can really create problems, so that every 10 years we get new population counts and we redraw districts to have population equality. And there's some good reasons for that, but that also means that every 10 years, those elected officials are getting a chance to fine-tune districts and pursue certain corrupt opportunities to either protect friends or hurt enemies. And it has the cumulative effect of that has actually been a lot less competitive districts, even though the old method of not districting in a lot of states obviously had big problems too.
Yeah, it violated one man, one vote, basically.
Well, which is defined in a sense of having equal constituents, you know, the equal number of people in the same district. But it certainly can mean that you have a lot more votes cast in one district than another, which, by the way, we often get anyway during the course of a decade. Like people in Nevada probably know that the area around Las Vegas is shooting up in population, and I think they had a district that had about 400,000 more people than another district by the end of the 1990s. So we still get violations of that principle, but at least then, come 2000, we correct it.
It should be corrected. Jerry, good question. Thank you.
We're
talking about redistricting proposals, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Another question. This is from George. George calling us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hello.
Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had one question. Once you've decided on your main goals, why not use an impartial computer algorithm to do it and set it and forget it?
Well, that's in a kind of close to what they're doing in Ohio, or the proposal is on the table in Ohio, which is that anyone can come up with a plan that theoretically could win there. And there is a tradition in Ohio, which is one of those states where this issue has been debated for a long time. There's been some very smart advocates of it, to what they call remove discretion, you know, that this should be a criteria-driven process and actually a criteria-governed process. It's that transition to governing the process that can be complicated because, yes, it's important to have this conversation about criteria. I think it really should be as governed as possible by criteria. But come the time to redistrict, it's plausible that there are certain developments that have happened since you established your criteria that might make those criteria not seem fair to people anymore. And that's why they tend to try to have an element of personal decision-making going in for these commissions. But the more of that there is, the more controversy that flows from them having discretion.
And besides, if it's corrupt, we don't have the fun of throwing a computer in jail. And
there you go.
What good is that? George, thanks very much for the call. Here's two emails. This from Remco in Cornish, New Hampshire. Why not get rid of districts altogether? That's the only fair way, so the number of representatives is proportional to the number of votes. We talked about that earlier. This from Dennis Burke. Arizona voters, through a ballot initiative in 2000, created a politically balanced citizens commission to redraw our state and congressional district boundaries. I led that effort, says Dennis Burke. How did it work out in Arizona?
Well, Dennis's effort is actually the model that I think a lot of the reformers are pointing to. Look, this can win at the polls, and they did win a strong near landslide win at the polls in 2000. And credit to them for taking this seemingly esoteric issue before a lot of people were talking about it and winning. But it is interesting to then look at what happened with the commission. Is it did remove some of the controversial elements of redistricting. You didn't have politicians in a self-interested way drawing their own districts. However, there have been 16 U.S. House races under the new plan, and 15 have been won by at least 20 points.
Incumbents have lost. Not very competitive.
Exactly. Yeah. The number of women in the state legislature actually went down in 2002 after redistricting. Now, whether that was impacted or not, but at least the people drawing the lines, I think, didn't factor in representation of women as one of their criteria. So that's all to say that it's that it certainly isn't the be-all, end-all, but it is an example that change can happen.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email question from Barbara Clough in Olmsted Falls, Ohio. If the redistricting is given to an independent board, who will the board be? She also adds, will taxpayers have to pay their salary? I'm for an independent board, but not too thrilled about paying for any more salaries. but if it's an independent bipartisan board, aren't you then sort of recreating the problem in miniature?
Well, it seems to be at least one of the possible outcomes, and there were several state legislative commissions in 2001, 2002. And one of the things that I think is really important here is that every single state legislative plan that was drawn by legislators resulted in no turnover. There was not a single chamber that changed in a district plan that had been created by the people who then ran in those districts. And there were several that did change, and they either came from redistricting commissions or from judges who drew plans. That shows the power of drawing district lines. However, some of those changes in district chambers that flowed from what a judge did or from what a commission did was very controversial and seen by certainly the losers in the process as very partisan. And they could claim it's not accountable either. Like, these people weren't elected, and then suddenly they're changing the political power structure in this state. You know, is that fair either? And they did tend to have some leeway. They had political data to be used. And if you don't use political data, then you can't try to create competitive districts because you don't know what it is to make them competitive. But if you do use political data, you're open to charges that you're trying to help one party or the other. And that definitely happened in several of these states.
And very quickly, Joe Hallett at the Columbus Dispatch told us earlier that the proposal there is failing, is running behind in opinion polls. California the same?
It looks like it's going to lose too, but I think the conversation's only beginning here. Certainly the problem is not going away.
Thanks very much. Rob Ritchie is Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. He joined us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we'll be talking about other matters on the election ballot a week from today. Governors, mayors, that sort of thing. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're talking about issues that are facing voters next Tuesday. And, of course, we invite you to join the conversation at 800-989-8255. NPR's senior political editor Ken Rudin is with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks, Ken, for coming in.
Hi, Neil.
And I guess the highest profile races for the governorship of Virginia, Democrat Tim Kaine and Republican Jerry Kilgore are in a tight race there. Is this or any race that's happening this year seen as a proxy for a national fight?
No. I mean, we've seen in the past that sometimes you can decide that what we see in an off-year election like this, it does mean something. We saw in 1989, for example, David Dinkins was the first black mayor of New York City, Doug Wilder, the first black governor of Virginia, first black governor, period, mm-hmm. elected in Virginia. And then 3 years later, we saw Bill Clinton elected. So sometimes it does lead to things. But for the most part, these are very localized. You know, all politics is local, especially this year.
And those of us who live in and around Washington, D.C., have seen a ton of advertisements this year about the governor's race in Virginia, which seems to be, nasty.
Well, it's nasty. So is the governor's race in New Jersey. But what's interesting about the Virginia race is that, again, this is a state that George W. Bush carried handily both times, 2000, 2004, and yet the latest polls show 55% and higher disapproving of the president's performance, and that has to help Democrat Tim Kaine. He's a lieutenant governor under retiring governor Mark Warner. Virginia is the only state in the country that you, one governorship and you're out. You can't seek a second term. But what's interesting about Mark Warner, he's leaving office with 75% approval ratings in the popularity polls. And if that's the case, one, it's good news for Tim Kaine, and two, it could project Mark Warner to the presidency because he's obviously looking at 2008.
And some people have noticed that President Bush has been in Virginia, just across the Potomac River from where he lives most of the time, a couple of times in the past couple of weeks, and Republican gubernatorial candidate Jerry Kilgore has found reason to be elsewhere.
Right. The president was in Norfolk last week for actually a presidential visit, not a campaign visit, and Kilgore was noticeably absent. But it's interesting, you know, we talk about who's going to win the presidential nomination for the Republicans in 2008, and we talk about conservatives. We talk about the Sam Brownbacks. We talk about the George Allens. But yet, when these candidates want Republicans to come in and campaign for them, they don't go for the conservatives. Jerry Kilgore, the former attorney general in Virginia, who do you have in? Rudy Giuliani, John McCain. It's interesting who these Republicans want to campaign for them.
The governorship in New Jersey, a lot of money in that race, John Corzine.
Right, John. Well, both candidates are multimillionaires. The Republican Doug Forrester also has lots of money. But Corzine spent $60 million plus to win the Senate seat 5 years ago, and now he's leaving to want to be the governorship, want to be the governor as well, and he's spending a ton of money as well. Both candidates are self-financed. That's why Virginia is seeing so much money, because since the New Jersey candidate is so heavily financed by themselves, the national parties could afford to move into Virginia.
And let me ask you also about a couple of mayor's races. New York City, Mayor Bloomberg seems to have that race pretty well locked up. And we're now going to see something a lot of people would have said impossible, two consecutive two-term Republican mayors in the city of New York.
First time in history. And that's what's so remarkable about this. New York City is 5-1 Democratic. Michael Bloomberg actually was a Democrat. He became a Republican solely for running for mayor in 2001. But given the fact that the city has recovered tremendously from the terrible bombings of 9/11, the attacks of 9/11, Bloomberg is getting a lot of the credit. And the Democratic nominee, former Bronx Borough President Fernando Ferrer, is not taking advantage. Basically, Ferrer is being outspent 17-1. His only hope is an act of God, really.
Mm-hmm. And one more race, and that is for mayoral office in St. Paul, Minnesota, in which one of these nonpartisan races where they have a primary and the two top finishers then run off against each other if nobody gets a majority in the first race. A conservative Democrat incumbent is racing against a more liberal Democrat, and the incumbent is losing badly.
He's losing badly. And again, as we saw, we just said that President Bush is an issue in Virginia. It's an issue in St. Paul, too. The mayor of St. Paul, Randy Kelly, who's a Democrat, endorsed George W. Bush for re-election in 2004. Well, you know, that's one thing to do. But St. Paul is an overwhelmingly Democratic city. It's hard to make the case why he would do that, but he did. And the vote, if you look at the polls in St. Paul, the reason Kelly is going to probably lose his bid for re-election is because of the endorsement of George Bush in 2004.
City's otherwise doing pretty well.
The city is doing well, and Kelly's record is pretty good.
Ken Rudin, thanks very much. A less interesting political year than average, but...
Not true. Never. There's no such thing as a non-interesting election year.
We'll thank NPR's Ken Rudin for joining us here in this thrilling electoral year to bring us up to date. He's also the author of the Political Junkie column, which is just up this week. And the title of this week's column, I'm told, is Tom, Dick, and Harriet. Ken Rudin, if you can stand more of it, at the website npr.org. Ken Rudin, thanks very
much.
Thanks,
Neil.